dying, Father. Is nothing left. Ever since I was a child, I had the feeling that something is missing me. I want to know why I'm here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Let God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful.
Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lines to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact science. And that is why you are here.
History to the unknown future. This is Red Ice Radio for the Seeker.
And knowing, I must strive to know.
Welcome, everyone. I want to extend my thanks to you for your interest, for listening. My name is Henrik. RedIceCreations.com is the website. And as we say now and then at the beginning of some of our programs, we investigate claims and research. We present interviews with people that we find interesting from different backgrounds with various critiques all across the board. We have done research in various fields related to hidden history, cover-ups, corruption, and so much more. Whether you agree or not is your business. We have two somewhat different programs coming up back-to-back, both connecting in some way. The first one that we're doing today is with Michael Hoffman. He is a former reporter for the Associated Press and the author of 6 books of radical history, journalism, and literature. He describes himself as a heretical writer. Hoffman is also the managing editor of the newsletter Revisionist History. We have 2 main themes for today's program, the resignation of the Pope and usury. We begin discussing Pope Benedict XVI's abdication, and Michael questions who procured his resignation, and he talks about ruthlessness in the pious conclaves. We'll also discuss Masonry within the Roman Catholic Church. Then we talk about his new book, Usury in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now Is Not. Michael explains how the Renaissance, with the De Medici at the forefront and later the German banking family, the Fuggers, was not a great rebirth, but instead saw the rise of the machine of the social robot, the rise of money, power, and usury. We get into how the attitude towards usury was progressively changed through various ecumenical councils. He talks about usury in religious doctrine and the early Protestants' resistance to the usury revolution. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program, and thank you for taking the time talking with us. I know how busy you are and how much you're involved in currently, so thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Henrik, for having me.
You bet. It's going to be really interesting. There's so much to talk about, of course. Many years ago, I read your excellent book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, on the Masonic cryptocracy, Twilight Language, and more, and maybe we'll have some time later to discuss that. But why don't we begin to discuss the I guess it would be the biggest news in 600 years, the Pope, as we know him, is currently going to abdicate, resign, throw in the towel, whatever you want to call it. And I want to hear what you think about all of this, Michael.
Well, the last Pope to resign, Dante put in his Inferno and placed him in a low region of hell. I wonder if the same fate will befall Ratzinger. And I wonder what the status is of an ex-pope, if indeed there is such a thing, since the post-Renaissance Catholic Church posits the idea that the current pontiff has Holy Ghost or Holy Spirit inspiration. Is that then withdrawn by virtue of a legal act of the College of Cardinals, which numbers among them numerous usurers, facilitators of child molestation, and exploiters of people in general? So that's one issue that intrigues me, as well as the symbolism and many of the unanswered questions that continue to surround the entire spectacle.
So what is the official reason why he's resigning?
The official reason is that he's too frail to continue. But by the evidence of my own eyes, it appears that that isn't true. He doesn't seem to be a very thin or slender man. He seems to have a good appetite. He's ambulatory. He has recently traveled, and I expect at his age as an octogenarian that he isn't going to be absolutely fit. But it seems to me, with the tremendous office responsibilities and duties associated with the Roman pontiff, that he would have an obligation as the papa or pope or father of this universal church to continue on unless he was severely paralyzed or otherwise disabled. And I don't see that. And so that leads me to the next question. What's the real reason for his resignation, since the officially put forth one seems to be specious on its face?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there understandably there's so much commotion around the Catholic Church in the recent years, child molestations and the consequent cover-ups of that. And I can't help to think, Michael, that this is in some regard a, I don't know if what we could call it, the political move to try to get someone else in there that could do a better job at trying to restore the seeming power, I guess, that the Roman Catholic Church has lost, and the, you know, the declining credibility. What do you think about that?
Well, that's interesting, but the question is, who has the power or authority to procure his abdication? Did he do it voluntarily? One wonders. He certainly has a mission. He sees himself as an important theologian, and indeed he is, in terms of modern Germany and modern post-conciliar, as it's called, theology. He's certainly an intellectual and a refined man, has a lot to say, and was very active in his papacy. And we do know that there's been tremendous disruption in his curia, but that's pretty typical for the curia. It's usually the captive of the Italians, and with all due respect to our Italian brethren, there seems to be a tendency towards a Machiavellian manipulation of bureaucracy in Rome, and the Pope has inherited that. I don't buy the notion that that's more labyrinthine or corrupt than it was under John Paul II. However, it did garner more negative publicity, and that may be another issue. So my question would be, who has the power to take the sovereign pontiff and more or less persuade or dictate to him that he has to leave in this unprecedented fashion? That harkens back to the alleged assassination of Pope John Paul I, and whether or not some type of threat along those lines was put forth to Benedict XVI to move him on. But you may be correct in the sense that the cryptocracy sees his pontificate as more and more a public relations disaster, and they wanted someone who's more credible. And I haven't really taken a poll, but insofar as I have my pulse on American Catholics, in the limited sense that I do, it seems that most are swallowing the official story, that this was a great act of humility on the part of the Pope, very self-effacing, and does credit to the hierarchy itself. So in that, so far, the media is playing along. It's a publicity coup. But it still makes me wonder how this was actually engineered, if indeed the official story of near incapacitation is untrue.
Yeah, good point. And the question then is, as you said, who would have the power to do this? And are we merely talking about someone else in the ranks of the cardinals that actually want to get in there and try to do their job at restoring this you know, ongoing disaster, if you will? Or is it more nefarious than that? Is there a bigger power grab happening behind the scenes, Michael? What do you think?
Well, we'll know more when we see who the new pontiff is, because we'll be able to examine his circles of influence and who he has around him. But this reminds me of a conversation I had with Malachy Martin, who's the author of a number of lurid books about the Roman Catholic Church. He certainly has sterling credentials as the former peritus or theological expert to Augustine Cardinal Bea, who was largely responsible for the pro-Zionist document of Vatican Council II called Nostra Aetate in our time, as well as an advisor to Pope Paul VI. So his credentials are good, but I don't trust him because he wore a false face in a number of his books, and he had really had a checkered career. But nonetheless, having said that and put forth that caveat, I had dinner with him in 1978 in the wake of the assassination of Pope John Paul the First, mm-hmm. and the conclave, which had gathered in August to elect John Paul the First. And at that time, he gave me what he claimed was inside information about that conclave. So I guess we'll have to take that cum grano salis, but I'm going to repeat it here, because if it's true, it's an indication of the ruthlessness, the type of horse trading which takes place in these supposed pious conclaves. And what Martin told me is that Cardinal Peronio was the choice of the cryptocracy back then. He's now deceased and had a largely obscure career, but he was the choice, and that Cardinal Benelli, Giovanni Benelli, the cardinal from Florence, more or less took charge by means of blackmail, and that on the second or third day of balloting, he put forth a series of dossiers which were put on the desks of some of the cardinals who were leaning towards Peronio. And Martin alleged that inside those dossiers were photographs and documents related to, as Martin said, the boyfriends, the girlfriends, and the Masonic membership papers of those cardinals. And that as a result of that, the cryptocracy's candidate was defeated, and Albino Luciani, the Cardinal of Venice, that is to say the future John Paul I, was elected on a fourth ballot. However, as you and I both know, and your listeners probably are aware, he was dead 33 days later, 33 being a significant number, yeah. and under very dodgy circumstances indeed. So these conclaves are not the kind of holy environment that a lot of perhaps gullible people imagine. And so I think a good indicator, in fact, I know a good indicator will be who, in fact, takes the reins from Ratzinger, from Benedict XVI. That's going to be important to know.
Well, indeed. And you said Masonic membership papers? Wait a minute. Hold on. I thought membership in the Masonic ranks were pretty much forbidden by Roman Catholics, correct?
Well, yes, officially. But Bugnini, Archbishop Annibale Bugnini, who is credited with being the architect of the Novus Ordo Missae, or the new Mass of Paul VI, which replaced the Tridentine Mass, which goes all the way back to Pius V, and some Catholics would argue goes all the way back to apostolic times. And that was certainly a revolutionary overthrow when the Tridentine Mass was suppressed by the Roman Catholic post-Renaissance Church itself, after it had fought so hard in the 16th century to prevent the Tudor Protestant monarchs from suppressing it. And then in the 20th century, it actually fulfills what the Protestants of England had tried to do. So this was a head-spinning revolutionary turnabout, which some analysts see Annibale Bugnini being responsible for. And while I haven't seen a smoking gun for his Masonic membership, it is known that so much pressure was placed on Paul VI that Bugnini was exiled toward the end of his career. Formerly powerful prelate, was exiled to Iran back in the pre-revolutionary days of the Shah, and that was considered more or less a career dead end. And certainly there's been strong conjecture and supposition about him being Masonic. But I think that ultimately you can see that there is a symbiotic relationship between the occult, Masonry, and the type of occult which allegedly reigned among its opposite number in London, England. And we can get into that later on in the broadcast. But I don't accept the idea that the Roman Catholic Church in its hierarchy is anything that it represents itself to be. Certainly the run-of-the-mill parishioner and their parish priests usually are people of integrity and do try to conform to the official doctrines, but that has seldom been the case since the Renaissance at the very top of the church hierarchy, in my judgment.
How interesting. Very, very interesting indeed. And, of course, we need to talk about all of this as well, Michael. The Second Vatican Council, what happened? This is, of course, just a continuation of something that I think you point out actually began back in 1515, if I'm not mistaken. And this is at the time, of course, when we have Pope Leo in place, one of the De Medici.
Yes. One of the big issues for me is the usury issue, since Jesus Christ and the gospel of Jesus Christ and his apostles had made the famous statement that the love of money is the root of evil. And Jason Berry has written an important book that I recommend to your listeners called Render Unto Rome, and it's about the corrupt finances of this Renaissance Catholic Church. You notice that I distinguish between Renaissance Catholic Church and its forerunner, and I believe that there's an important distinction to be made between the Apostolic and Medieval Church as it existed, which I think did try to combat the money power. And then we see the infiltration of the church beginning at least exoterically, beginning with the pontificate of Leo X, who, of course, is the one who oversaw the great breach, the rise of Protestantism in the face of the rage of Martin Luther over Roman usury and, of course, other issues like the sale of indulgences, which is actually related to usury because the same bank, the same Roman Catholic bank that was promoting a 5% interest on loans, which was unprecedented in the history of the church, was also collecting the indulgence money, that is the Fugger Bank of Germany. And this outraged Luther and helped to lead to the Protestant revolt or Protestant Reformation, which I believe much of the responsibility for which can be laid at the feet of Leo X, who at Lateran Council 5 in May of 1515, using the pretext of helping the poor and using the pretext of trying to overcome Judaic Shylock type of usury, said that we will allow interest on loans if those loans are given to the poor. Well, actually, as I show in my book, Usury in Christendom, those Monte Pietatis banks that were operating in Florence under papal charter were actually funneling the money to the Medici themselves.
Well, we have to switch over to cell phone here at this point. We're having some issues with Skype, keep cutting us off, but this is interesting and we want to hear what you have to say about this, Michael. You were talking about the de' Medici, the selling of indulgences, and how the banks got involved in Vatican business. So maybe you can pick up where we left off.
Okay, certainly. Well, what we have is we had a philosophy beginning to emerge in at the dawn of the Renaissance called nominalism. And this was at the German University of Tübingen. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correctly, but and of course that university is still known as a center of radical innovation. But in the around the end of the 15th century, nominalism began to emerge, and one of the prime exponents of it was a Catholic theologian by the name of Johann Eck, E-C-K. Now, he's largely known to history as the nemesis of Martin Luther. They had a series of textual exchanges, very fierce and acrimonious debates about Luther's position and Eck as defender of the papacy. And what happened, though, and what's unusual is that Eck was actually an agent of the Fugger Bank. And he was being paid to enter into different disputes and debates. For example, at Ingolstadt, Bologna, he conducted a series of debates. And of course, he was very astute. There's no taking that away from him, where he began to advance the revolutionary notion of the 5 centum or 5% interest rate on commercial loans. The Fuggers were fabulously wealthy bankers. They had their finger in almost every Catholic dynastic pie, if you will, from Charles V, the head of the Holy Roman Empire and the recipient of the wealth of the New World, which the conquistadores were funneling to Spain. Charles V had more or less been promoted and bankrolled on his way to the top by the Fuggers, so he owed them tremendously for the various favors which their gold had bestowed upon him. And their power and influence ran east into Italy and Austria, and of course Germany at that time was a number of provinces under the rule of the Holy Roman Emperor. And therefore Eck was an influential agent of that bank, but the Fuggers were very concerned about the fact that they did not have prestige. And in fact, in many cases, they were abominated as usurers, one of the most hated epithets that could be applied to any Catholic. And so they were looking to rehabilitate their reputation as much as enhance their usury operations, because in general, they had been able to get away with this usury for quite a long time. It was the basis of their fortune. So They were interested in as much in rehabilitating their reputation as they had been in trying to expand their usury operation. And one aside here, in spite of the fact that many Roman Catholics have attempted to unfairly blacken the reputation of John Calvin, and there are plenty of reasons to criticize John Calvin, but what I'm going to bring up here is not one of them. Claiming that Calvin was the great innovator who granted permission for usury, this is absolutely not true. Mm-hmm. Calvin wasn't even alive when these events were taking place. But one interesting thing about Calvin's attitude towards usury and usurers is that he abominated them. He did allow what Eck was pushing for. Calvin allowed the 5% interest. In fact, I think he learned that doctrine and that permissibility from this Roman Catholic nominalism, which greatly influenced him as a hair-splitting lawyer. I mean, he was basically a French lawyer. And so he was as interested in what was called equity at that time as the law of God, which is very strange for a fellow who has a reputation as being a fanatical biblicist. But anyway, what he did was he said that usurers were more or less the scum of the earth, and he taught that until the end of his life. So paradoxically, Calvin more or less reluctantly, it seems to me, granted this 5% interest permission, but at the same time continued to cast opprobrium on usurers. And I believe that that's rather important because the Fuggers were so determined to have their reputation rehabilitated. They wanted to enter into the highest levels of aristocratic and church society, and the opprobrium that had been in place since apostolic days was a barrier to that. And it's interesting to me that Calvin had maintained that barrier in spite of his reputation. But anyway, returning to Eck, so here we have this figure of a person who's claiming that Martin Luther was a revolutionary and a heretic, and at the same time is engaged in the heretical and revolutionary process of fronting the Fuggers' financial imperium of interest on loans of money. And this is where we begin to see this symbiosis as Tetzel is collecting selling the indulgences, because the Pope is involved in building St. Peter's Basilica, which was done with usury and indulgence money. And as he's selling these indulgences, the people who are in charge of the cash box, and you couldn't make this stuff up. I mean, this is just only history could produce something like this, the documentary record. The Fugger agents were in charge of the cash box. So they were implicated in both the sale of indulgences and in usury. And the theologian that pious Catholics turn to as supposedly representing the traditions of the Church, Johann Eck, against the revolutionary or supposed revolutionary Martin Luther, was actually a radical innovator on this key subject of how the money power is able to prevail both during the Renaissance and in our time. Of course, many of the sins of the Renaissance are covered up by the magnificent artworks that were produced in that time. But what I would say to people is my principal concern in my career has been following the trail of criminal politics. And so it doesn't really matter that much to me whether if, for example, in 2013 we had a Michelangelo who was creating magnificent aesthetic works, but at the same time was robbing the poor, was lying to people and exploiting people and adding more to the crime and exploitation of what Christ called the least of my brethren. So I don't want to seem to be a Philistine when it comes to art, but I believe that the notion that the Renaissance was this great period of rebirth of science and of art, I have to return to the insights of Louis Ferdinand Céline, the great 20th century French novelist who was a medievalist in the core of his being. He actually wasn't even French. He was a Breton. But he made the statement, which first got me on the trail of this, actually, where he said that the Renaissance actually saw the rise of the reign of the machine and the social robot. And I also feel that that is part of it. But basically because this is commensurate with the rise of the money power, which continues to be a curse on us today. And here we see, returning to our original theme of Pope and the Roman Church. Here we see the corruption at the heart of it. I feel that so many Catholics pursue the symptoms of the corruption, but don't go to the root of it. And I feel that any good investigator, if they don't deal with roots rather than symptoms, are going to be lost in the hall of mirrors.
Wow, interesting points there, all of it. And also I want to try, I mean, first of all, I didn't know about the Fuggers. It's very interesting as you talk about this to learn that the Fuggers basically took over many of the, you know, de Medici's assets and their political power and influence and kind of continued that, if you will. But one thing I want to try to get to is how, through all the ecumenical councils and all that, did this all of a sudden change? I mean, because this must have been also decided upon on the levels of cardinals and popes and everything else, that okay, let's try to, you know, reform the Catholic Church basically and make it into something that accepts usury and but before it didn't. So is it a specific council that this took place under?
Well, I wonder if it was a reform. Certainly, that would have been the propaganda story. I think that it goes back to the occult roots of the Church in the Renaissance, and I believe that basically what we have here is a process of gradualism. The revolution is advanced by not ruffling the feathers of the people and not making it too obvious what's going on. So as you legalize usury, you do it in the name of the poor, you scapegoat the Judaic people who are involved in Shylock type of practices, and you say, well, we're going to defend you against their 30% interest rates, so we're going to have a 5% interest rate. Now, to me,
right.
that's patently and obviously wrong, since it's like me saying, well, I don't want you to go to a $1,000 prostitute. I'm going to help you with a $100 prostitute. I mean, the principle of corruption remains the same. But basically, only the hierarchy was aware of this in 1515. And slowly, by a process of gradualism, these practices expanded and became more and more out in the open. But what we have is for example, the Catholic Counter-Reformation. The culmination of that was at the Council of Trent. And Trent was very concerned about the Protestant criticism of Catholics being usurers, because people like Martin Luther and many Anglican and Puritan, again, Puritans are probably among the most hated Christians in the eyes of the New Age, but, and there, again, there may be some solid reasons for criticizing the Puritans, I'm sure there are, but we shouldn't do it on the basis of ignorance. And sometimes New Agers pick up Renaissance and post-Renaissance Catholic propaganda about the Puritans, one of which is that they were very miserly and niggardly type of bone sharks and greedy people and so forth. But actually, if you read the original documents, as I have, by people like William Greenhill or Anglicans even, like Bishop Jewell and others like them, you find this magisterial jeremiad against usury and against greed. And so these Puritans were pointing to Leo X, these Lutherans, these Anglicans, some of the best and better and most insightful of them, we're pointing to what Leo X did and the gradual process of expansion from his original directive at the Lateran Council, and saying the Church has become usurious, and this is another sign that it needs a reformation. So the response of the Council of Trent was to reaffirm the ancient medieval statement against usury. Its very definition, the definition is any interest on money. Nowadays, the modern definition of usury is exorbitant interest, whereas most modern people would regard moderate interest as not being an issue. But that's not what the Church taught for more than 1,400 years. The Council of Trent returned to that, and the Council of Trent is regarded as the supreme dogmatic teaching council in the Catholic Church, and it was employed against the Protestants. In fact, the statement in the Council of Trent, this would be mid-16th century, the statement against usury even goes so far as to quote Cicero's citation of Cato, Cato being the Roman in antiquity, and this is one of the strongest statements against usury in the whole of Western civilization, and the Council of Trent is quoting it dogmatically, and that is where Cato is asked what do you think of usury? And he says, well, you might just as well ask me, what do I think of homicide? Mm-hmm. So Cicero quoted approvingly of Cato's equation of usury and homicide. The Council of Trent reiterated that, but what I suggest in my book is they did it for window dressing. They did it as a refutation, as a reproach towards the Protestants to say, your criticism is false. We're reiterating the ancient doctrine. The reason that I'm suspicious about it is there was no teeth in it. All of the usury operations that were in place continued onward, and the church, other than some naive local bishops or local parish priests who were inspired by that statement to try to do something, but the church at the highest levels did nothing. And so the process of greater and greater permission and expansion of usury in the church continued apace until the middle of the 18th century, when you had Pope Benedict XIV issue an encyclical called Vix Pervenit, in which many Catholics who don't understand the level of dissimulation and deceit that's operating from the hierarchy have pointed to and say, this is a magnificent document reaffirming the church's traditional stand against usury. Well, about 90 to 95% of the encyclical is that, but there's a couple of paragraphs there where the new teaching is inserted in a very sly and clever way. And what he basically says is that administrative fees can be charged for loans. Well, in my opinion, administrative fees are a euphemism for getting around the usury laws, mm-hmm. usury prohibition. And he also redefines profit off a loan in terms of it not constituting usury. It's a very slick document. And what I find sinister about it is that most Catholics actually quote it as a way of suggesting the Catholic Church hasn't changed its teaching on usury. But a couple of bombshells came along, and I'll try to be brief here. One was in the pontificate of Pius VIII in the next century, where the Church was finally being called to account on the basis of confession. Roman Catholics believe in auricular confession. So they go to a priest in secrecy and in privacy. They tell him their sins. The priest grants them absolution, and then they are freed of the wages of their sin. Well, what happened is that usurers were coming into the confessional, and they were notorious usurers, and in some cases the priest knew the identity of the person in the confessional. The person would say, well, I lied, I shouted at my wife. And then the priest would say, well, what about the loan operation you're running? And the user would say, I don't feel guilty about that. Well, the priest would report it to what's called the penitentiary, which is the Vatican bureau that's in charge of all the issues related to confession. And it came out in the 19th century, the ruling from Pius VIII was that usurers are not to be disturbed in the confessional. Mm-hmm. And this outraged, in my book, Usury in Christendom, I talk about the case of Father Callahan, Father Jeremiah Callahan. He was outraged by this, and he led a campaign against it, which ended up exiling him from Ireland to Vermont in the United States, when Vermont was basically a howling wilderness. Although he was such a dynamic man, he did a good job there. So what you had was, you have another piece of the puzzle, which Catholics, I think, even now continue to deny. Hopefully, after reading my book, they won't be in this denial, but That was a major revelation. Also, Leo XIII, who tried to oppose communism at the end of the 19th century with his encyclical Rerum Novarum on the condition of the working class. It says many eloquent and decent things about the rights of workers, but it doesn't say anything about usury. So the root of the love of money and the engine by which the money power oppresses all of us is ignored in a document which is hailed by many Catholics as being in favor of the workers. I don't think so. And the Freiburg Union was a Catholic study group. Many Catholic aristocrats against usury tried to influence Leo XIII in the writing of his encyclical that he would speak against interest on debt, and he did not. And then finally, what we have is, and this should have awakened people like G.K. Chesterton and other English Catholics, very famous and eminent writers, who continued to say, repeat like Paris, the Catholic Church hadn't changed its stance on usury. And in spite of all of the documentary evidence in front of them, if indeed they had gathered it together, but how could you ignore the 1917 Code of Canon Law, promulgated in 1918, formulated in 1917, promulgated in 1918 by Pope Benedict, and now we have Benedict the 15th, and which it says that there is no penalty for usury. It says it in a roundabout way, but that was the sum effect of it. Jesus Christ said, by your fruits you'll know them. And so everything, all the proscriptions against usury were completely lifted. And in 1983, under the pontificate of John Paul II, a new code of canon law was promulgated that went so far as to say that Catholic clerics who do not invest money that is given to the church in interest-bearing loans are running against the directives of the Vatican. So now we have a kind of compulsory usury. And of course, who can deny the Vatican Bank and the machinations that we saw in the 1980s with one of the bankers hanging from Blackfriars Bridge in what appears to me to be a ritual Masonic murder, and Michele Spindona and the rest of it. And so this is a brief survey of how the church gradually changed itself, and there are, this is analogous to a revolutionary change in the liturgy, which started out as gradual and then culminated in a basic overthrow of the Tridentine Mass.
Wow. Well, they've certainly come a long way, because I remember back in 2011, the Vatican was basically calling for a global world bank, something that's unheard of before. They seem to have gone in the complete opposite direction. And the question as well is, Michael, was this something that was further enforced, if you will, during the Second Vatican Council, or how can we tie that into all of this?
I wouldn't say that the council had much to say about usury, but then that would have been one of its defects. Because since usury was now raging full bore, and what had been condemned not just by the great saints and popes and councils of the medieval era and earlier eras, but the great poets and thinkers like Dante Alighieri was being ignored. But for me, the central problem of Vatican Council II was the statement about Judaism in Nostra Aetate. Not everything, in my opinion, was bad about Vatican Council II. Mm-hmm. For example, at long last, there was a repudiation of the murder and oppression of people identified as heretics. Religious liberty was affirmed. Now, conservative Catholic critics of Vatican Council II will say religious liberty is Masonic. I think that's an enormous failing of vision when there is no evidence whatsoever that Christ himself advocated the persecution of any heretic. Very briefly, in John 6, he promulgates the doctrine that unless you eat his flesh and drink his blood, you will no way have eternal life. And some of his disciples at that point said, that's a disgusting doctrine. And they walked away from him. There's no statement about him saying, okay, go after them with swords or jail them or burn them. There's nothing like that. So it's not, religious freedom doesn't originate with the Order of Freemasons, who are very hypocritical in applying their claims to freedom. Just ask William Morgan or Thurlow Weed in New York in the 1820s when they were persecuted and murdered and printing plants burned down by Masonic mob.
Yeah.
It's not Masonic. It goes all the way back to Christ. So there were some good aspects to it. But, for example, John the 23rd's Ajurmento, his formulaic slogan for this notion of opening the church, opening the windows of the church to the world. Well, that militates against everything Christ said. The world represents the flesh. Christ represents the spirit. But when he's talking to the Samaritan woman at the well, and she says, you are the noble and high Jews. You have these holy places. And Jesus said, what is a holy place? The place is holy that is hallowed by the Spirit. So this militating against the flesh and the world is at the very core of the Christian message. And yet in order to pander to the spirit of modernity, which, as you may imagine, I'm very much opposed to, John the 23rd brought about Ajurmento. It's interesting that he named himself John the 23rd, when in fact there was a previous John the 23rd that was an anti-pope. Mm-hmm. And so this set some people on edge and made them a little bit more vigilant about his papacy. But real problem is And Malachy Martin, who I referred to earlier in the broadcast as having been someone that I was able to interview in the 1970s, Malachy Martin was a descendant of both Irish people in Ireland and also Judaic bankers who had sought exile there. It seems to me he had some core sympathy for the Judaic version of usury. Unfortunately, the Gentile version of usury, up until perhaps the time of my book now, has been policed out of the equation. Some people make usury and Judaism synonymous, and that's very unfair and historically incorrect. But nevertheless, we don't deny the existence of it, because according to the Old Testament, Israel has the right to use usury as a weapon of warfare against alien people who are using sex magic to worship false gods, although that's certainly not the reason why most Judaic usurers use the weapon of usury against the Gentiles. But that there is a biblical root to it, so it's not completely incomprehensible, whereas it is, there is no root for Christians whatsoever. Jesus in Luke chapter 6, verses 34 and 35, tells us to lend freely, expecting nothing in return, even unto your enemy. So there's no Christian basis for it.
Mm.
But Nostra Aetate in our time was this heavily influenced by Talmudic sources who were involved in the early stages of preparation for the Second Vatican Council. And it basically said that the Judaic people could not be held guilty for the crucifixion of Christ, either in his time or in our time. Well, certainly in our time, a Judaic person that's just a regular Joe, he happened to be born to a Judaic father and a Judaic mother. He doesn't care about the Talmud. He's not really involved with the Palestinian issue. He's just living his life. He has no guilt or burden for what happened 2,000 years ago in Jerusalem. But if you claim to be a Christian, to negate the clear statements in the Bible about who had responsibility for the crucifixion of Christ, Paul the Apostle makes the statement, Matthew makes the statement that this was the responsibility of the Pharisaic leadership of those Judaic people who had rejected Christ, or Jewish people actually in that time, we could use that word. And therefore, this was a great betrayal. It was evidence of the spirit of gradualism, where gradually the church was evolving out of a faith that had a relationship with biblical integrity into a faith that would be amenable to the modern media and the modern world in general. So that for me, the Vatican Council was an exoteric emergence of an esoteric phenomenon that I think had been gestating inside the church since the Renaissance. For example, if we take the official psychodrama about Henry VIII and his divorce, this is supposed to be a story or a tale of the staunch Catholic Pope resisting divorce and resisting the blandishments of Henry VIII and losing Great Britain for the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
But if you delve into it through Dame Frances Yates and other scholars, you find that when Henry VIII, who started out as a good, solid Roman Catholic, and even towards the end of his days, after he had executed his wives and destroyed the monasteries and wrought havoc on the church in general, always adhered to the old Latin Mass and insisted on a celibate clergy. So in the early days of his career, his conscience was heavily burdened about the idea of divorcing Catherine of Aragon and marrying Anne Boleyn. Well, we find out through Francis Yates and other sources that he actually derived his commitment to proceeding with the divorce from a Roman Catholic prelate inside the Vatican who was part of this Neoplatonic Kabbalistic movement that you saw arise commensurate with the arise of usury in Florence with people like Marsilio Ficino and Pico della Mirandola and others like them in Germany, Johannes Reuchlin. And from that, Roman Catholic prelate consulted rabbis on the issue of divorce, and so a rabbinic gnosis on divorce was transmitted by the Vatican to Henry VIII, leading to the rise of the Anglican Church and the position of divorce. So what you have is you have a complete contradiction operating inside the Vatican, and you have a false faith, which is the whole story of history. It's your job and it's my job, it's our vocation to try and deconstruct and decipher the false faith that the flesh, the world, presents to us as human beings who are trying to aspire to something higher. And people that don't recognize that some of their most cherished institutions, which they, through a process of mystification and a process of hierarchical awe for these hierarchies, which Christ rejected. He said that was a feature of the Gentiles, and that I will not have that among you. And yet in his name was created a hierarchy, which creates a false faith, a Janus faith. And so for me, Vatican Council II didn't emerge out of the Enlightenment per se, which many traditional or conservative Catholic critics, that's what they see as the root of Vatican II.
Yeah.
Change agency emerging out of Kant or out of the French Revolution or Descartes. I see it as being much earlier and as being part of this eternal pagan psychodrama, which both emerged among the Pharisees in Christ's time as their oral tradition, and in the Catholic Church, not only in the usury permissions, but also in the Neoplatonic movement of the 15th century.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, this is very interesting. We're going to take a short break at this point. We're going to continue with the second hour and talk more about Michael Hoffman's work and, of course, his latest book, as we're talking about here right now, Usury in Christendom, The Mortal Sin That Was and Now Is Not. Before we take a short break here, Michael, please give us your website so people know where to go to read more about you and where they can pick up copies of your books, etc.
Well, thank you very much, Henrik, for the opportunity. That would be, the URL would be www.revisionisthistory.org.
All right, there you go. Revisionisthistory.org. We'll carry on here with more. Michael, stay with us. We'll continue. We'll take a short break here at this point.
Oh, Lord, you made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, it's no shame to be poor. But it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? If I were a rich man, I have a dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. All day long I dibba-dibba-dibba-dum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. I have a dibba 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 dum. If I were a bitty bitty rich, idle diddle 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 man, I'd build a big tall house with the rooms by the dozen, right in the middle of the town. A fighting roof and a real wooden floors below. There would be one long staircase just going up, and one even longer coming down, and one more leading nowhere just for show. I'd fill my yard with chicks and turkeys and geese and ducks for the town to see and hear, squawking just as noisily as they can. And each loud gee-bidi-di-goo-bidi-di-gay-bidi-di-ga will end like a trumpet on the ear, as if to say here lives a wealthy man. Oy. If I were a rich man, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a bitty, bitty rich, idle, diddle, diddle, diddle man. If I were a rich man, all day long I bitty, bitty bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Oh, yabba dibba 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 dibba.
Lord, who made the lion and the lamb, you decreed I should be what I am. Would it spoil some vast eternal plan if I were a wealthy man?